It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book Close Encounters of the Worst Kind and the captivating memoir Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Americans facing the myriad distractions of modern life might be tempted to make light of ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, as an explanation for our frantic, fragmented focus as a nation and as individuals. But adult ADHD is a serious condition that, left untreated, can derail careers, destroy relationships, damage self-esteem, and even kill people. Yes, it can. Too often, we don't recognize it and thus cannot treat it effectively. Today's special guest, Dr. John Cruz, has set out to change that with his provocative new book, Recognizing Adult ADHD, What Donald Trump Can Teach Us About Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. With a doctorate degree in basic neuroscience and an active psychiatric practice, Dr. Cruz throws cold water on the Goldwater Rule, which prohibits psychiatrists from giving professional opinions about public figures without personally conducting an examination. The president, he says, embodies a condition that affects millions of Americans, yet it is poorly understood and often diagnosed. Dr. Cruz has been a psychiatrist for 25 years, treating people with both medications and psychotherapy, but his focus is on adults with ADHD. And now I'd like to introduce him to you so we can get started. Good morning, Dr. Cruz. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you.
Yes, I'm really excited about talking with you, too. So, yes, it is a very provocative title. And as someone who writes books, I know when you put something out there, it takes a lot of guts to do it. So why did you choose to use President Trump as an example of the title of the book and talk about him throughout the book?
There already exist dozens of very well-written, very good books on adult ADHD or ADHD in general. But my experience has been the people who are reading those books are the people who already identify with having ADHD or have already been explicitly diagnosed with it. And every study, every epidemiologic research suggests there are millions of Americans with ADHD, with it impacting their lives, the lives of those around them, who are completely unaware of it. And my thought was we need to find ways to reach those people. And Donald Trump could not only be the poster boy for ADD, he's a poster boy for severe ADHD that's right in front of our faces and nobody's talking about it. So the hope was people who might be interested in the president or might be drawn into reading something they might not otherwise pick up or not otherwise start thinking of.
Okay, and that makes a lot of sense.
Sure. And sort of a secondary issue is 30, 40 years ago when we had a much more, the network news was where everyone got their information. We were all aware of the same pop stars or football sports heroes. You could pick on a figure like that and almost everyone would know who they are. But in this much more fragmented media world, Donald Trump is one of the very few individuals where if you start describing his behavior, virtually everyone will know what you're talking about. Whereas if I were talking about even Kobe Bryant, lots of attention recently then, people who, many people don't have a clue as to what he looked like or what he did if they weren't following basketball. And yes, his following was bigger than just basketball, but there are very few people who everyone understands what you're talking about when you start describing certain behaviors.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is, his behavior is known worldwide. I speak to people
yes.
in all different countries, and they always bring him up. So you're absolutely right. You said in your book, in the early 1990s, anyone who had ADHD as a child outgrew it by the end of adolescence. Published reports from decades before that era describe adults with ADHD, but used a variety of older names and diagnostic titles, such as minimal brain dysfunction. I never heard that. Is that still used?
It's not still used, and it wasn't even widely disseminated. It was used, but it wasn't a common diagnosis back then because, I mean, essentially the field felt that these kids who had it outgrew it, and, you know, people weren't looking. Some of the symptoms are more subtle, particularly, you know, not too many people run around in circles as a 25-year-old while they might as a 9-year-old. So it's sort of, if you're not thinking about it or looking for it, you don't see it even again when it's right in front of you.
Right. It's true. It's true. So in your book, you say that childhood ADHD can have three different trajectories. What are they?
So the kids who have ADHD, I mean, we have varying statistics, and some of them are just defined on how many symptoms you need to have to be considered to have the condition. But I'd say very roughly, they break, you know, of kids who clearly meet the diagnostic criteria, about a third of them do seem to fully outgrow it by the end of adolescence, very early adulthood. Another third don't seem to get any better during that time and go into adulthood with pretty much full-blown ADHD. And the middle third gets somewhat better, and it may be their condition at themselves. It may be finding a better niche in their environment to fit into. But they have what we might call subsyndromal ADHD, where they're still displaying some set of ADHD symptoms, but not enough or not severely enough to meet full criteria still. So we have the get out of it completely, not get out of it all, and the middle group somewhat better.
Okay. You cite some statistics in your book. You say of the 250 million adult Americans, the most conservative estimate suggests at least 2% or 5 million individuals have full ADHD, but more expansively, 16% or 40 million individuals are on the spectrum. That's, you know, a significant amount of people. That's a significant statistic. When you talk about being on the spectrum, what do you mean?
I'm referring to what I would call it that middle third of individuals who, again, met full criteria of ADD as or ADHD as a youngster, but are displaying fewer of those as an adult, but are still showing some problems with attention or some problems with impulsivity or some problems with emotional dysregulation is actually quite a common aspect of ADHD that doesn't get a lot of media attention. So these are still people who are being affected, but again, may not meet the full criteria for a diagnosis. And in adults, the full criteria you only need to meet 5 of the behavioral criteria, 5 of 18 that are described to meet this condition.
Okay. You talk about Lucy in your book, and that was an eye-opener. You say that, you know, she was hospitalized with suicidal thoughts and was treated for mania. And then they sedated her with antipsychotic medication, trying to stabilize her mood. And when they discharged her, she just felt terribly misunderstood and jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. That was such a sock in the – that was like a wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember commenting out loud as I'm reading that. So you say missing a diagnosis of ADHD risks substantial adverse effects and can even be lethal.
Yeah.
And in what other ways can this be lethal?
I mean, one would be jumping to the subject of my book, you know, Donald,
right.
Using him as an example. Again, and we can go into more detail if you want, but he does meet the criteria for ADHD, which are objective behavioral descriptions, so we don't need to know his motivations or other things. But just, I mean, his behavior in terms of interactions with Iran is informative. So not just the most recent drone bombing of General Soleimani, but 6 months earlier when he ordered the launching of missiles at Iran after they had shot down one of our drones, and then realized, quote, in his own words, oh, that it might kill some people, so he called back the missile strike that he had ordered. That is pure ADD behavior of acting impulsively without thinking through the ramifications, and that came very close. You know, if he had not called back the missile launch quickly enough, we would have been killing thousands of people on the ground there, maybe, I mean, depending on where they struck, but it certainly would have resulted in death there and probably greater repercussions back and forth.
Okay.
So other areas, I mean, we know the mortality rates of people with fully diagnosed ADHD, I mean, the likelihood of dying in car accidents, of other accidents in general, are about 2 or 3 times what the background rate in the population is. The rates of these people for being incarcerated or put, you know, in jail for serious crimes is about 2 or 3 times the background rate. And there's, in addition to just sort of the dramatic overt suicides, accidents, there's pretty good evidence that people with ADHD as a group are less good about taking care of their own health. So diets are poor, sleep is poor, and those have longer term implications on health. Although it's harder to say this person's heart attack was due to their ADD. It's more like their ADHD was a contributing factor.
Right. I mean, no, but we wouldn't really even associate ADHD with being, you know, having lethal effects. That's amazing. What are the physiological differences between the brain structures of someone with and without ADHD?
I always treat this question a little gingerly because I think sometimes psychiatry's attempt to sort of legitimize itself as a science makes statements that are sort of beyond what we can be absolutely sure about, given that the brain
okay.
is so complex. And my best example is sort of the story that's still out there that depression is caused by serotonin depletion, and that's why Prozac and other drugs work. And there's sort of a kernel of truth embedded in there, but flat out on the surface, that's actually not that simple or that true. So I'm going to speak more in general. I mean, so with ADHD, in terms of biological factors or brain factors, I mean, one, we know that there's a very strong genetic component. It's not a single gene causing it, but ADHD runs very strongly in families. The genetic predisposition or control influence over ADHD is at least as strong as the genetic influence over height, you know, which is pretty good, but still, you can, you know, be 6 foot tall and have only had a 5'6" father. Within the brain itself, in terms of the neurochemistry and neuroanatomy, there's certainly lots of findings with dopamine neurotransmission. In terms of brain structures and growth, overall, kids with ADHD have brains that are slightly smaller. There's differences in the thickness of the cortex, particularly frontal cortex, but also in other places like the cerebellum. And more importantly than just static single differences, the developmental patterns of the brain seem to be delayed as a group in kids with ADHD. They look like their brains are just maturing more slowly, and that some of them may never get to a point of full maturity in terms of what areas develop cortical thickness. But rather than focusing on specific brain areas or specific neurotransmitters, there's much more interest now in sort of looking at whole networks and what parts of the brain are well connected together and what are less tightly tied together, and there's growing evidence, and it's much more tricky to study brain networks, but that the brain networks sort of linking the frontal cortexes, which we think are sort of the controlling, guiding parts of our body, our brain, are less tightly or rigorously linked to other parts, including emotional centers, including movement centers, including planned completing action centers of the brain. So I know that's a fairly vague, and there are people who, you know, label more specific areas and say we know this is a dysfunction here, but I'd say it's still a blurrier concept, and even people who can identify, you know, problems in dopamine neurotransmission in the frontal cortex, for example, those differences aren't big enough to go into a brain, look at a brain scan and say that individual clearly has ADHD, because there's such an overlap between the group of kids or adults with normal brains and the ADHD group. So most of what we're still finding are group differences, and they're not strong enough. I mean, we do not have a brain test for ADHD or depression or almost any of our other neuropsychiatric problems right now.
Okay. Thank you. That's I understand why you had to be so broad with that, you know, because yes, everything that I read about every kind of mental health condition, often it affects the brain structure. So there's so many, you know, factors that can, things that can factor into the way the brain looks.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a correlation between ADHD and OCD?
Yes. So one is the rule in mental health is comorbidity in general. I mean, if you have depression, you're more likely to have anxiety problems in the general population. But with an ADHD or ADD, most studies suggest half to two-thirds of people have at least some other condition, and depression is common, anxiety problems are common. And one of the most surprising ones is what you just picked out, is OCD. Because at a superficial level, many people think of ADHD as almost the opposite of OCD, that with OCD, someone's doing something repetitively over and over and is fixated and can't let go, whereas with ADHD, at a superficial level, they may be scattered, bouncing all over the place and not doing anything consistently. But the research has shown that maybe as high as 30% of people with ADHD do meet some significant OCD criteria. And in some cases, the OCD seems to be actually attempts, conscious or not, to counter the ADHD. So some people with who would otherwise have very messy desks, you know, have learned that I need to obsessively minimize and clear everything off, and that's the only way I'm going to function or get through. And again, they didn't plot it out as a conscious strategy, but they may have developed sort of OCD tendencies that every single speck of paper has to be off my desk. Otherwise, I mean, that's what I need for comfort, but the comfort is comforting actually the ADD symptoms they have. Other people, it doesn't seem as clearly linked to a strategy or a reparative attempt to deal with their ADD symptoms. It just seems that that is there and part of their probably biological makeup or tendency.
And you also say that individuals can have both ADHD and bipolar disorder. And again, having one, either one increases the likelihood of having the other.
Yes.
But
yes.
But it's very difficult to differentiate, right?
It's quite difficult, and I mean, particularly probably in children, but even in adults it can be confusing. And the example you brought up for my book of Lucy is a good example. That someone who's in the full-blown stages of mania can resemble someone with fairly severe hyperactive forms of ADHD. So they may be talking a mile a minute, they may be jumping from topic to topic, they may be restlessly pacing around. There are some hallmarks of mania, I mean, in that situation, that are not common in ADHD. So almost everyone with mania that severe and this may be merging into some of your expertise in narcissism, but with mania, most people become grandiose. You know, they have an overinflated sense of their own value and importance and ability to do things. That's not a standard feature of ADHD. With mania, often it's veering into psychosis or sort of delusional thinking. There's usually much more, both of them can have impulsive symptoms, but in full-blown mania, hypersexuality, hyper-religious focuses are very common, and that's not a particular feature with ADHD. But the bigger differentiating point is the life course over time. So if someone, and in my book, I discuss Lucy, and I saw her scores of times over more than a decade. Every single time I saw her and everything she could report and friends and coworkers would report, if every day you're talking a mile a minute and jumping from topic to topic and can't sit still, that by definition isn't mania, because mania by definition is an episode that's different from your baseline. So taking, you know, careful history is just the way the person always is. And part of it with Lucy and a few others at the extreme ADD spectrum, the assumption by an emergency room staff who are just seeing the person at the moment is sort of, this is too extreme. This couldn't possibly be how the person always behaves. So they, I mean, that's, I think, one of the biases towards mania. I think another bias has been there are certainly fads in mental health treatment, and although there's some people who still discredit the whole ADD diagnosis and consider that a fad, a more recent fad, I'd say, has been bipolar disorder, and some people define it so broadly that almost anyone who comes in the office or the emergency room can be diagnosed with it. So I think there's probably in the last decade, and it's, I think it's declining, but certainly there was a period where bipolar disorder with its consequent manic episodes was being widely overdiagnosed.
Bipolar is overly diagnosed. Many of my clients have come to me after being misdiagnosed as bipolar, because when you've been abused by someone with narcissistic personality disorder, your moods and behavior can be all over the place. You don't know what you're doing half the time. So, yeah, bipolar gets overly diagnosed, and it's one of my pet peeves. It really bothers me that that happens. But I understand that it's difficult to differentiate. But, you know, you sort of, you know, when you talk about the baseline and everything, that's, you know, that kind of helps understand.
I just wanted to strengthen one point you sort of were bringing up and I touched on, and that is so much of the discussion with ADHD is sort of focused on school settings and whether someone's distracted in their cognitive attentional processes. But we know that about 2/3 of people with ADHD, and it's particularly the hyperactive, impulsive variety, have significant emotional dysregulation. That is a strong central part of the ADD diagnosis. And that, again, if you're thinking in terms of ADHD just means distracted, and you see someone who's emotionally all over the place in the emergency room, I can get why you wouldn't even think of ADHD, because that doesn't seem to be an ADHD symptom in your categorization, but it very often is.
Right. You know, people who have been severely traumatized as many narcissistic abuse people have been, can appear very anxious and fidgety, and, you know, so it can be similar. You say that although the interactions can be complicated, most people with PTSD don't have ADHD, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So that's interesting to me. How so?
I mean, so there's some of that is a reaction. There's at least one, and he was actually a family practitioner, but he's written several books. He's a Canadian author, and his name is not coming to mind quickly. who almost brings us back to the 50s and 40s when we were blaming mothers for everything. So he believes that ADHD is purely PTSD, a form of bad mothering, and it's really PTSD that we're confusing with it, and that according to him, all the individuals he's evaluated with ADHD, if you go back, there were mismatches between what the kid needed and what the mother provided. Mm-hmm. So my trying to separate them out more strongly, partly as a reaction to, I don't think the evidence supports that. I mean, I think, again, when we were talking about comorbidity, we know that people with ADHD are more likely to have car accidents, to run into a whole variety of other traumatic experiences, and just for that reason, they do have more trauma in their lives, and they do have more PTSD than the background population group, but it's certainly not a majority of people with ADHD having PTSD. And again, as you were pointing out, many people with PTSD have some ADD-like symptoms of, they may be hypervigilant, they may be have trouble focusing or attention, but you know, if the symptom is attributable to PTSD and they don't have other ADHD symptoms, then, you know, that's the usefulness of the PTSD diagnosis, is to give them a label that's meaningful. So we don't want to overdiagnose people who have some symptoms that certainly look like ADHD, but if they're clearly connected to their trauma, then we give them one diagnosis rather than two. Hmm. So I don't know if I.
Okay. Yeah, I mean it's a little confusing, but yeah. So this is kind of the meat of the of my interpretation of the book. But why do you say that Trump has ADHD, not narcissistic personality disorder? And I know he is widely labeled with NPD, and he does demonstrate the traits of narcissistic personality disorder.
Yep. So two things, or a couple points there. One is, and partly I'm a working psychiatrist, but I have a training in neuroscience, so I'm and a PhD there, so I'm a little more, I think it's important to say what we can definitively say versus what we can suspect highly.
Okay.
And again, ADHD, whether or not it's a well-written diagnosis, it's the diagnosis we've used for clinical work and for research for years. And it is the one diagnostic criteria set in modern psychiatry that is based purely on observable behaviors. And by I mean purely, I mean lots of our other personality disorders involve behaviors, but you have to know the motivation for that behavior. So with ADHD, the behaviors that are described are, does he walk around when it's inappropriate to be walking around? Is he interrupting others more frequently than others? Does he have trouble sitting still? Does he make mistakes through missing data because he's inattentive? And those, an outside observer watching videotapes or, you know, just sitting in a room looking at him, can determine, separate from what's inside his head and what's motivating him. Whereas with narcissistic personality disorder and our other personality disorders, even we need to know that he's being dismissive towards whole populations of people because he thinks lowly of them, or because he thinks so much of himself, or, I mean, ultimately that his sense of himself is so fragile that he has to beat down other people to feel good himself. Mm-hmm. So at one level, I think the difference is, I argue that unequivocally he meets full objective criteria for ADHD, that there's, I mean, you can argue against not even believing in psychiatry, but if you accept the definition, which is the definition, he has it.
Okay.
With narcissistic personality disorder, I'd say we have overwhelming pieces of evidence that is extremely likely that his behavior is consistent with those patterns, but unless we know what's motivating him at each moment, I'd say it's harder to make a definitive statement.
Okay.
So I'd say that's a different. And then what I get into more detail and what's sort of frustrating to me is that there's, I think, a lot of confusion or misinterpretation of what happens. So one of the examples I bring up is when Donald Trump flew to North Korea for the second debate with Kim Jong-un, when there was all of his aides were telling him, everyone's saying, you haven't prepared anything. There's nothing, there's no agreement in place. And he flew there, you know, proclaiming there'd be some great breakthrough and settle. And everyone in the media labeled it, this is purely a sign of how narcissistic he is, how narcissistic he is. And my take is, a narcissist wants to look impressive and successful and good. They plan ahead. They do
That's
their
true.
Homework. You know, even
That's
if
true.
You're sure of your, you know, that you're so powerful and wonderful as a human being, everyone's going to wind up agreeing with you. Even then, you prepare. So to me, this was much more an example of his narcissism. I mean, sorry, not of his narcissism. I mean, there's certainly elements of that in there, mm-hmm. but it's sort of pure classical ADHD behavior of acting impulsively without being aware of the consequences, not doing your homework, you know, not preparing ahead. So that again is one example. I'd say another reason for sort of drawing out the distinctions, almost every ADHD book that is out there will also talk about that many people with ADHD do appear self-centered. And in my book, I use an example of Frank. So he's a patient. He's actually the patient that got me started in working with adults with ADHD. I was seeing him weekly for more than 20 years.
Wow.
And almost a quarter of the times he came in, he would spend 20 minutes talking about, he just got off the phone with his girlfriend. They were talking for 30, 40 minutes. And at the end of the conversation, she said, Frank, we've just been talking about you. You haven't asked me how I'm doing. And then he would go on to berate himself in the session for 20 or 30 minutes of how, and he always pronounced it narcissistic rather than narcissistic, but how narcissistic he seemed and he would appear to her, and how upset he was at hurting her feelings, and how he does care about her, and can we, you know, keep working on finding ways to remind himself to ask about her. So to me, I mean, he's an extreme case, but this highlights his behavior, even to himself, looked narcissistic, and to her looked narcissistic, but the very fact that he's so concerned about her feelings and what he's doing in his interaction with her that's hurting his feelings is saying this is not narcissism.
Exactly.
This is someone with ADHD who is fixated on sort of what's in front of him, and what's in front of him is his problems, and that's what he goes with, even though some part inside would be saying, you know, ask about her, find out how her day is going.
Right. Exactly. Well, so, I mean, you would say that that's definitely, you know, that Trump, I don't believe that he cares about who he hurts. I really don't think he cares about it, even when it's pointed out. And that is one of the hallmarks of narcissistic
yep.
personality
yep.
disorder. So, yeah, I mean, we could argue this back and forth, but I can see where you say that he has the ADHD. I mean, that's clear. So you think that ADHD is contributing to his sexism and racism and admiration for authoritarians. And that also sounds like NPD too. What would separate ADHD in those areas, you know, his focus on sexism and racism and admiration for successful people?
So the argument I'm making there, and it's more provocative, and I don't know how many other researchers do or don't agree with what I'd say there, is that there's a strong propensity for people with ADHD to pay attention to visual stimuli, to be somewhat surface focused and go for sort of what's flashy, what draws their attention, rather. So when he's sexist, when he's making a judgment about women, is it that he's really in his belief system devaluing them, or is it his sort of ADD that's drawn to looking at a woman for her appearances versus her brains or her strength of her character or something else?
Objectification. You're talking about objectification.
Yeah. Yes. Well, okay. And again, there's some. So the difference is, if you have, and I'll make it sort of an extreme, say someone's purely just ADHD, but they are noticing who comes in the room, and this person has a short skirt or a large breast or beautiful hair or whatever their eye is focusing on, they may blurt out comments to that. That's what they're observing. And they may not. So that would be an ADHD picture. The narcissistic personality disorder or a devaluing perspective would be in the process internal inside of them would be all these women who are coming in here are just meat and I'm only looking at them for these details anyway. I mean, it's hard to know from the outside.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's hard to know. The behavior on the outside may look identical.
Right.
And it may take a period of time. I mean, hopefully, if it's truly coming from an ADD dimension, with more time, with more interaction, then it's clear that the person's interacting or respecting or looking at other aspects of these people and valuing them as people.
Hmm. Okay. This is so interesting to me. No, that's why.
So one of the tight connections or blurring with ADHD and narcissism that I go into a little bit is something called positive illusory bias. And then, so when you look at kids in general overinflate their abilities. So if you ask, you know, how fast can you run a mile or are you the smartest kid in your class? Measurably, kids overrate their abilities. And as they get farther along in middle school and adolescence, they become more accurate observers or obsessors of themselves in general.
Right.
If you look at groups, kids with ADHD are even more as a group, and there's certainly kids who feel badly about themselves. As a group, the kids over-exaggerate their own abilities to even a greater extent. And what's been called positive illusory bias is this trend, and it's not everyone with ADD, but it's a subset, and it's been more looked at in boys than in girls, who are more overly optimistic of how good they are at certain activities. But unlike normal optimism, and most of us, I mean, there are values to being over-optimistic and over-evaluating to a little extent our own abilities and achievements, because it would be hard to get through life if we didn't. But with normal optimism, if you present someone with the data that, you know, your score on the math test was actually in the bottom third of this class, they reassess their opinion, and when you ask them again later how they assess themselves, they won't put themselves at the top. One of the oddities of positive illusory bias in kids with ADHD is even if you present them with the information, that doesn't change their reassessment of how good they are. And two other things. One other thing that a positive optimistic bias seems to do for most of us is that it helps us persevere or stick on a task longer if we're thwarted or challenged or if it's difficult. So if you believe you're good at math and you're given 20 really difficult math problems, you stick with it better if you have a view that you're good at this than if you're believing you're lousy at this. The weird thing, again, with positive illusory bias, it doesn't help. Again, these are kids with ADHD, but they aren't sticking better with difficult tasks. So it's not acting like just normal optimism. It's not helping them stick to tasks. They're not good at reassessing themselves with new information. And again, most of positive illusory bias has been studied in kids, but some of that looks identical to Donald Trump's behavior. I mean, that even when presented with information of how poorly he's done at something, he'll come back and tell you that he's the most stable genius. He's the this or that. And again, my gut feeling is some element is almost certainly narcissism, but maybe it is this sort of disturbed cognitive processing of positive illusory bias, and maybe even more of it's a manifestation of the ADHD than we appreciate.
Right.
So.
The difference between ADD and ADHD is the hyperactivity factor. Is there a chemical reason for having that hyperactivity factor? How are they different? You know, how do you? Tell me. You get it. You know what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, some of it is pure sort of nomenclature. So for a period of time, you know, we didn't even know this existed or have a name for it. And so most clinicians, patients, and researchers sort of glom onto the title that they were, that was prevalent when they were learning it or diagnosed or using it. So right now, officially, according to the DSM, all of this is ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But we break it down into three types: an inattentive type, a hyperactive impulsive type, and then a third group, which is combined type, who has features of both. And actually, about 2/3 of people fall into this combined type, so it may not even be that useful a distinction. So I know there's some individuals, particularly with inattentive ADHD, who strongly like the ADD label and say, I'm not hyperactive, you know, don't put me in that group. But again, officially, it is all ADHD. I sort of slip back and forth between the two. So in terms of why is someone inattentive and why is someone hyperactive and why does someone have features of both, it does seem that there are some gender factors at play. So there really do seem to be more women who are purely inattentive type. But there are certainly women, and Lucy in my book, and you know others, there are certainly plenty of women with both hyperactive and inattentive features. So we don't have good, you know, biochemical markers or brain markers that I'm aware of that differentiate one group from another in terms of who's likely to develop one way or another.
Okay. Are they, would they both respond the same to stimulants like Adderall and things like that? Because if you give Adderall to someone who doesn't have ADHD or ADD, you know, it's speed for them. But doesn't it have the opposite effect on ADHD?
So that's
okay.
Good question. So with speed, or maybe even we can take caffeine, if you take a small amount, you may not feel anything. If you take the right amount, you're alert and focused. And if you take too much, I mean, most people who are coffee drinkers have done it at least occasionally. If you drink too much, you're overstimulated, over-revved up, jittery, hyperactive. People with ADHD don't actually respond any differently to these substances than normals. What's different is sort of the dosage that they may need to move them from a place of inactive, unfocused to focused. So with the child who looks hyperactive and is running around the room, but give them Adderall or Ritalin and they're sitting there calmly, it's not that it's overtly, directly sedating in a way that Valium or too much alcohol would be. What's going on is the kid's running around the room because, here, they're looking at the squirrel outside the window. Oh, no, they're listening to the airplane that just flew over. Oh, they're swiveling around to this other kid who threw a ball across the room. It's that their attention is so out of their control that they are jumping from item to item to item to item. And when you give them stimulant that helps them focus, then they can sit there and watch the squirrel playing outside the window. They don't need to respond to the ball being thrown or the teacher saying or the jet flying overhead. So the calmer behavior isn't paradoxical in that their brain is wired differently and they're getting an opposite response. It's that their we are moving them from the unfocused level into the focused part of their realm. And even people with ADHD, if you push the dose high enough, they will become jittery and hyperactive even. And part of my frustration with this point is that so many adults, including so many pharmacies, see hyperactive adults with ADHD, and their reaction is, this person's already on stimulants. I don't want to fill a prescription for them for Adderall or Vyvanse or Ritalin, when actually giving them the medication would help them calm down and focus and appear more normal-like. So I'll segue into Donald Trump, because one of the things I discovered when I was writing this book is there's a meme on Twitter of people talking about his snorting Adderall, using stimulants, and they were blaming lots of what I am calling his ADD behavior on the fact that he's snorting Adderall. And I don't, I actually have some evidence that he is using stimulants at some time, but when he uses stimulants, so there are some times in important speeches like his State of the Union speech, in his third debate with Hillary, times when he knows he needs to act quote unquote presidential, where his verbal rambling, jumping all over the place, incoherence, I would say, where his speech mm-hmm. becomes much more coherent by measurable, where his physical activity drops to a third of his background hyperactivity, and where his pupils are substantially dilated. The dilated pupils, all these three things together are compelling evidence that he is taking some stimulant medicine at some time, but that when he is doing that, he is actually more calm, more grown-up-like, more presidential, more functional.
Huh.
So rather than mocking him for taking stimulants and creating this craziness, as I say, and this is somewhat flippant on my part, I said, instead of riffing on his sniffing, we should be supporting his snorting. You know, and not that snorting is a good way to get these medications at all, but that these people who are criticizing it have it exactly backwards, that these are medicines that would help him organize his thoughts, help him be less impulsive, help him stay on track with his speech, help him blurt out less often, help him not launch missiles preemptively at Iran or wherever mm-hmm. else he might be tempted to launch missiles.
Interesting. So we should look for the dilated pupils. That's a way to
and
tell.
And encourage that. Yes, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Have you seen the documentary Free the Mind on Amazon?
I have not seen that.
Oh, my gosh. You have to watch that. So they talk about treating PTSD through meditation and breathing, and they actually
mm-hmm.
show the difference. But they also deal with this. They also focus on this one child who has been traumatized. He's obviously hyperactive in class. When everybody lays down, he keeps lifting his head up, and his hands are moving and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they use the mind jar. Are you familiar with the mind stress jar?
Yep.
Okay. So, and I found this so fascinating where it's like a snow globe, you know, and they shake it up and everything's all crazy in there, and they compare that to the activity that the child is feeling or the stress they're feeling, and then the child
mm-hmm.
watches it, you know, settle. And it was amazing to me how they were able to work with this child. That was one of the tools that they did. But if you have Amazon Prime, watch Free the Mind. It's really, really,
okay.
I mean, I couldn't look away.
Thanks.
Yeah. So is this a condition that can be cured?
So what's interesting in childhood, I mean, there's a lot of concern by parents that these stimulants are heavy-duty medicines, that they do have uncommon but really severe potential for bad effects, potential for addiction. And there's a whole sort of culture, we don't want to poison, destroy our kids' brains, but we have in childhood more than 24 studies looking at kids with ADHD who either took stimulant medication during childhood or who were unmedicated. And at the end of adolescence, almost all the studies, something like 23 out of 24, showed more normal-looking brains in the kids who were on medication. So at least during childhood years, we have the story almost exactly backwards. We may actually be sentencing some kids to a lifetime of ADHD if we don't treat them with medications.
If we don't treat them, okay. So the treating.
If we don't treat them, because they're so the kids who are treated with these medications that some people see as poison or horrible have brains that look more normal than the kids who never were treated with ADHD.
Wow.
So we have normalized some brains. I mean, maybe some of them would have been the kids who would have outgrown ADHD anyway, but it's, I mean, the percentage we're seeing is much higher than what we would expect with just that conversion. Whether there's as much plasticity or the ability of the brain to change in adulthood is probably diminished somewhat. So the general recommendation is that to the extent an adult is getting value or benefit from stimulants for the ADHD symptoms, they are likely to derive that same benefit a decade later or two decades later. And, you know, there's certainly some kids who transitioned to adulthood or some people who started with adulthood who have been on these medicines safely and effectively for years, if not decades. On the other hand, medication is never the whole story. So again, this is not a simple neurochemical problem, even though neurochemistry is involved. This is much more a wiring, a network system process. And because of that reason, even really effective stimulants never eradicate all the ADHD in someone. So again, that's a difference from depression. So if someone comes into my office to be treated for depression, not that I can always get there, but a majority of the time, if not, you know, much better, we can completely eradicate depressive symptoms. We can get them completely out of depression, no residual factors. With someone with ADHD, the medications, yes, work quickly, but we never eradicate the ADD. They're always, you know, somewhat more impulsive or a little more inattentive or more likely to interrupt someone in a conversation. And part of that, I think, is a good thing because people often like the quirkiness, creativity, spontaneity, you know, the part that feels unique and different to them.
Right.
We don't obliterate it with the medications.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means we don't completely get them out of their ADD symptoms. Mm-hmm. So jumping back to it, so this is a long, long way of getting back to, so medications are part of the story, but another part is learning how your own brain works and how your own brain works with people around you and how your own brain works with tasks and jobs. So there are many people who, once they've learned more what their strengths and weaknesses stemming from their ADHD are, find jobs or find partners or find both that either supplement or mean they never have to get into the areas that are not good for them or that they're supported and reinforced. Or, I mean, I think part of Donald Trump's success is being filthy rich since childhood and having a whole host of people who would take care of his executive function tasks for him. So rich, I mean, when he talks about being a brilliant businessman, you know, when he survived five or six or four, whoever counts, bankruptcies, he didn't structure his business that way. It's the lawyers he paid to have them structure his businesses and protect himself so that whenever he goes broke, everyone around him is getting screwed and he gets off with most of his money intact.
We're coming close to the end. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're coming close to the end.
No.
But I just want to say, you know, I know you have a whole chapter in your book about positive aspects of ADHD because we've talked about, you know, I mean, you have mentioned some of the positive aspects of it, but just very briefly in about a minute or two, can you just mention some of the positive things that somebody would...
So one we were just touching on is creativity is widely seen as connected with it, and creativity is sort of the ability to take disparate ideas and combine them into something unique and new and useful, and that's probably tied in with the looser control of attention and distractibility in ADHD. High levels of energy are often there, although not always, and we can see this in Trump always criticizing, you know, low energy jab or slow.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
And one aspect in the political realm that I think is candor, so an authenticity. So President Trump, I think, does get credit for, and certainly lots of his following is because people says he's saying what he believes. I think the problem is twofold. One is people confuse candor with honesty. So candor is saying what you believe in the moment and being forthright in saying it. Honesty is about whether this is true or not. And measurably, you know, lots, you know, he's up to, what, 16,000 lies? Measurably, huge amounts of what he says are patently untrue. But he is sincere in the moment to saying. And then again, the other aspect of the candor is that, or tied in with his ADD, is that he says, you know, one moment this, believing this, and 10 minutes later, if he talks to someone else, he's believing or feeling something else at that moment. So I think one of the recipes for listening to this president is, in front of absolutely everything he says, because of his ADHD, you should put, this is what I am feeling at this particular moment.
Hmm.
And that also lets you not listen to him if you don't want to listen to him.
Okay.
Not even
okay,
getting
so I
want,
we're
false.
Running out of time. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I just don't want to close the show without focusing on your book. So your book is called Recognizing Adult ADHD, What Donald Trump Can Teach Us About Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And this book is widely available in Amazon and so forth. How can we get it?
Yes. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's available through Smashwords, which is an independent network. So it's there's an audiobook version, there's Kindle and Nook versions, and there's hardback and paperback books.
Oh,
and
very good.
Many libraries, I mean, it's can order it or can, yeah, or can order it if they don't have it in stock. So it's connected to the national distribution systems that way.
Amazing. Okay. And do you have a website?
My website is drjohncruse.com, and Cruse is K-R-U-S-E.
Okay. Awesome.
And the other little piece is on medium.com every week for the last 20 weeks, and I plan to do it for a year. I tie something that Donald Trump has done this week into some feature of ADHD to try to educate, again, more about aspects of ADHD that someone might not understand or be aware of, and I'm aware for some people the politics of that turn it off, but there's, I'd say, valuable content if you can get aside from that, and some people particularly appreciate that, but I try not to get into policy or actual political decisions. I'm trying
right.
to be talking about objective behavioral
okay.
symptoms, you see.
Sounds good. Well, I want to thank you so much for writing this book and for being my guest today. This is a lot. This is a really interesting conversation. So thank you so much, and I wish you great success with your platform here, your book and your platform, because I know you're trying to spread this word. So good luck with all of that.
Yeah, I really appreciated this opportunity, and I hope you get to continue it. Your work, which has been valuable in so many ways and touched and helped people.
Thank you so much.
Bad, dark places.
Okay. So take care. I have to say goodbye, but it's been wonderful.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. So we are out of time today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.